Legal Face-Off on WGNRadio.com is brought to you by McCorkle Litigation Services, leaders in court reporting and legal technology.
Hey, what's up, y'all? It's your man Montel Jordan, and this is how we do it. And right now, you're listening to Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. That's right, you're locked onto the high-energy legal podcast with lawyers Rich Lenkov and Tina Martini, and they're going to be trading jabs on the breaking news and the hottest issues, sports, entertainment, politics. Nothing is off limits. Keep listening, because this is how we do it.
Welcome to another edition of Legal Face-Off on WGN. Of course, we've got Tina Martini, McDermott, Will, and Schulte, and Rich Lenkov from Downey & Lenkov. I'm your moderator, Ryan Burwell. President Trump continues to fan the flames that he's considering a third term as president, something that hasn't been done since FDR. Here to talk with us a little bit about that is Michael Gerhardt. He is a Burton Craig Distinguished Professor of Jurisprudence at UNC School of Law. Thanks so much for coming on, Professor.
Thank you for having me.
So, even though Trump on Air Force One last week said it probably a third term probably isn't going to happen, I guess leaving some leeway there. He has been fanning the flames, as Ryan has said. In the 1 hour I think he spent on the government shutdown, in that meeting he had in the Oval Office, he was handing out, Trump 2028 hats. For those of our listeners and viewers who don't know, first of all, what is the problem with running for a third term?
Well, the biggest problem with running for a third term is the 22nd Amendment to the Constitution says basically you can't do that. No one can be elected to the presidency more than twice. Very plain language, straightforward. We should always be grateful when the Constitution is clear. It is crystal clear here. And it is crystal clear saying, no, you may not run for a third term.
So, Professor, against that backdrop, you've said there is no constitutional basis for trying to serve as president for more than two terms. With Trump publicly acknowledging he's unlikely to seek a third term, does that change the legal calculus, or do you think it simply reflects a practical retreat from a clearly barred path?
My thinking is that he is simply saying that to rile up the other side. You know, he can get under the skin very easily. He's very good at figuring that out. And so I think that's what he's doing. It's politics. He's basically trying to own the Dems. And I think at the same time, I don't know that he's thought through the legality or constitutionality of it all. But right after he had said recently, I'm thinking about a third term, Mike Johnson shut it down. And then the president himself seems to be backing. And that's because he did it for political reasons. And now he's having to back down because the law here is very clear.
Well, is it clear? Here's the three what I consider wacky theories, right, that are being floated, right? You're more familiar than I am, but let's break these down. Number one is that he runs as the VP,
right?
J.D. Vance, who is the current VP, and then they do the old switcheroo once they get into office and Trump steps up, much like, I guess, Putin did, right, years ago, where he ran as prime minister and then did the switcheroo. Number two is that he doesn't run at all, but that once elected, the Republicans, or at some point he's elected or appointed Speaker of the House, right? And then the number one and number two positions resign, thus making him, who is the, speaker's the third in line, making him president again. And then the third argument, I guess, is that there's some national emergency that warrants all these convenient constitutional rules to be thrown out the window and have Trump step in and save the republic. The fourth, that we'll get to in a second, is a constitutional amendment. That seems to be the only sort of rational planet Earth solution. But talk to us about the problems with the first three.
Well, as you point out, there's no problem with the constitutional amendment because once it's in the Constitution a different way, that's it. I think each of them has a flaw, may not be the same flaw with each of them. Obviously, if he runs for a third term, the plain language of the Constitution blocks him. That may have an effect within his own party, certainly would have an effect in any national election, could end up in the courts. And if the courts hear it, That's not likely to be good for him. So that option, I think, is removed. The option of running as vice president is an option that many people think is perhaps the one situation the amendment does not clearly address, because it focuses on elected president to two terms. And so if he's not elected, but he serves as a vice president, then becomes president, that seems to skirt the language of the 22nd Amendment. The question then, there are going to be two questions then that come up. One is whether D.D. Vance, let's say he's on top of the ticket, actually does step down. Hard to imagine anybody actually doing it in such a flagrant and unself-serving way. With all due respect to the vice president, he seems to be a little too eager to have power to be able to just walk away from the presidency after one day. And then I think the third situation doesn't help either, because one thing, if he's appointed speaker, that runs into a different loophole. The question becomes whether or not he's a member of the House. So if he actually ran for the House, got elected, served as a member of the House, and then was picked as speaker, that'd be pretty straightforward, and we'd be back to a different loophole. A lot of people would have to, let's say, disappear in order for him to become president. That can happen in Putin's world. Let's hope we're not living in Putin's world. And if he doesn't run for a seat in the House and somehow is still appointed speaker, there's going to be a lot of procedural mess from that. So I think whatever path he wants to choose, if he's going to try and force this, he's going to run up against a lot of walls. And let's not forget that his popularity is sinking, 37%, I believe, today. That doesn't sound like the foundation to try and avoid, or for that matter, violate a very clear constitutional amendment.
So, Professor, let's game out a little bit more what a constitutional amendment would look like. And, you know, is it something that's like door number four, or is it something that may be pursued on a concurrent path with one of the other options that you just talked us through?
Sure, you could combine them in any way you can imagine. So let's think of it as a spectrum. At one end of the spectrum, let's say the courts, I don't know how likely this is, but let's say the courts, particularly the Supreme Court, has a look at the President Trump trying to take advantage of a loophole. It's the court probably can go one of two directions. It can either say we're not going to address this at all, or they perhaps could entertain it, in which case they're then challenged to put their own credibility on the line to make a decision. Counter to the plain language of the Constitution is not a great position for anyone, including the Supreme Court. So I think we run into obstacles one way or another. And on top of all that, as I said, it sounds like a threat because it's a political move, but that threat doesn't carry much water right now because of his low popularity. Let me just also talk about the other situation that was mentioned, an emergency situation. Well, that too could be an abuse of the Constitution. And the reason is we have gone through great national emergencies and still had presidential elections. 1864, President Lincoln's in the middle of the Civil War. Nobody thinks he can't run. Lincoln himself does run for re-election, and it happens. And as we all know, he gets re-elected. In a different emergency situation, Woodrow Wilson, World War I, election happened. In World War II, FDR is running, and he is able to do that, and obviously he wins. So those are what all those together indicate is that There's nothing in the Constitution that prevents or precludes an election for the presidency being held, whether it's war, whether it's a depression, in any event, the Constitution is clear.
Professor, let's end with allowing you to put on your constitutional law professor hat and explain two concepts. Why is there a 22nd Amendment at all? Why is it so important? We did have presidents, last one being FDR, who served more than two terms, number one. And secondly, why is it so hard to amend the Constitution?
Well, I'll take the second one first. It's very hard to amend the Constitution because the Constitution's rules for amendment are very tough. You're going to have to get 3/4 of the states in all likelihood. There's no way in the world you're going to get 3/4 of the states to agree to a constitutional amendment on this topic. With respect to the former, in that circumstance, I got to tell you, I'm sorry, I forgot the first.
Why is the 22nd Amendment important? Why should we have term limit if the popular will is in support of a president serving longer?
Well, popular support doesn't allow anybody to violate the Constitution. So that's not relevant. With regard to why we have a 22nd Amendment, you just gave the answer, Franklin D. Roosevelt. Each time when Roosevelt ran for a third term, he was the first president in American history to do that. Obviously, he won. When he ran for the fourth term, almost everybody knew he was dying, but he still won. But it was clear, I think, to everyone that that should not happen again. It wasn't really an indictment of FDR. It's just that I think Congress and ultimately the American people thought, look, let's follow the Washington example, the George Washington example. Two terms and you're out. With Grover Cleveland, two non-consecutive terms and you're out. And obviously right now, President Trump is in his second non-consecutive term. So there's a great consensus that no one should be elected president more than twice. And given that that fits the language of the Constitution, I think it's pretty clear that we have an amendment directing us not to allow anybody to run for the presidency for a third term. If we care about the democratic process working as set forth in the Constitution, this is just a no from the very outset.
Professor Michael Gerhard, we'll have to see how the next 3.5 years plays out.
Okay.
We'll have to have you on in a couple of years to talk more about this, perhaps. Thank you so much for joining us on Legal Face-Off.
Thank you.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Tina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers & Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crain's Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off with Rich Lenkoff and Tina Martini. I'm Ryan Burrow. Well, a new report shows applications for law schools have jumped 33% over the last year. And here to talk with us a little bit about why that might be, we bring in Mike Spivey, founder and CEO of the Spivey Consulting Group. He has previously been a senior administrator at the law schools of Vanderbilt, Washington University in St. Louis, and University of Colorado. He's regarded as the foremost expert in understanding the impact that college and law school rankings have on higher education. Mike, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks. Thanks for the intro. Good to see you all.
See you too. So Mike, as Ryan profiled, according to newly released data from the Law School Admission Council, the current pool of law school applicants looks to be 33% larger than it was at this time last year. And last year saw a similar jump in the number of applicants. Tell us more about what's causing this trend.
Yeah. So when we get the numbers, it was 33% last week. It's actually 24.6% as of today. Over a two-year period, it's 63.7%. And I like your number 33% because the November LSAT registrants are in the 40,000s. It's the biggest test. Last year, they ended at 30,000. So it's going to go from 23 to back up in the 30%. I don't think you care so much about the numbers, though. I think you care about what's causing it and what stands out. Is that, am I right?
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like it's, you know, there isn't one sort of silver bullet here. It looks like there's a number of contributing factors. If you want to just maybe tell our listeners a little bit more about some of the contributing factors that are going into the increase in the applicants.
I would actually posit that there might be one vast majority factor in the first two are so intertwined. You could even say almost all would relate to this, which is number one, you don't hear the word recession used by economists in our current economy, but we're in an employment out of college recession. They started tracking in 1980 college graduate employment versus overall employment in America. For the only year ever in 45 years of doing this, this is the only year that unemployment for people graduating from college is above unemployment for the American average. So what you have is you have a lot of college students. Just talk to your friends who have children in college. A lot of college students, because of things like AI, because of things like the Great Stay, where people aren't leaving jobs, there aren't open jobs. What has happened every time there's been a recession since 1989? What happened during the Great Pandemic? 40 to 50% of law school applicants increased 40 to 50%. We're seeing the natural patterns of people can't get jobs. They flock to law school. And in this case, law school is looking really lucrative right now. The median starting salary, the adjusted mean, is $116,000. But the big firms for the years were locked at $165,000 starting pay. Guess how much they're making now? How much big law firms? Christina, you're about to graduate from law school. You go to big law. What would be your guess?
Two.
Yeah, $225,000. Mm-hmm. So I mentioned intertwining. You take the lack of ability to get a job and eyes get wide when you see that bimodal part of the right side of the curve of 225,000. People want to own a house in this country. You know, asset inflation is real. Houses still cost a lot. Gas still costs a lot. Groceries still cost a lot. So you couple the inability to get jobs with the 9.3 out of every 10 law school students has a job 10 months upon graduation, that's a strong 1-2 punch.
So you can't find a job coming out of school. You go to law school, you still have to pay for law school, right? I mean, I know that it's an investment given what you're saying, given the starting salary, but not everyone's going to a 225, you know, starting salary. So what about the rest of the people who have to pay for that law school? That is not influencing things apparently, because even with that debt, 66% of, you know, it's a 66% increase, right? So that's not a huge factor, I guess, taking on that additional debt.
I think people, you know, the running joke is that 80% of people think they'll be in the top 20% of the class.
Right.
Right. So there's still, it's called a bimodal distribution. If you were to look at who's at the pay, starting pay salaries, there's this steep thing at the right of 225 that you alluded to. And then there's this hump on the left side that's around 90 to 130. I don't think most people are looking at that little hump. They're looking at that really lucrative, steep things, and their eyes get real, real big.
So, Mike, what can applicants expect? I don't want to be Debbie Downer here, but when you've got a lot more applicants in an applicant pool and a surge of the kind that we've seen, what can applicants realistically expect as they go through this process?
It's going to be tough. It's going to be challenging. The definition of how competitive a cycle is literally as simple as how many entering class seats will there be and how many people are applying to law school. I think we're going to end up about 20% up. You mentioned last year we were up 18.3%. So you have this one thing that stands out to me is this thing's always on a pendulum. Applicants go up, applicants go down, but the curve is really steep. 18.3 followed by a 20% year would be something very anomalistic to us. And what that means is law schools aren't going to match that curve in how many people they bring into the law school. So it's going to be slower. It's going to feel like really slow because law schools are inundated with applications, takes them longer to read, and it's more competitive. It's just there's more people applying. It is a seller's market. Law schools are in a good position right now. And I see heads nodding. So, you know, it's instinctively you get that. It's not a buyer's market. It's a tough time to apply to law school.
So that being said, Mike, we have seen the last decade, you know, some high profile closing of law schools. I mean, locally here, Valpo, which was a really, you know, solid law school, closed. Do you think that we will see an uptick in new law schools or unaccredited law schools getting accredited? I mean, I'm thinking, for example, like Utah. Utah, I think, is the fastest growing state. It's one of the top five, right? I mean, it's a booming state. Yet there's, I think, two law schools. Indiana, next door to us, you know, it benefits from a lot of the issues we have here in Illinois. A lot of, you know, fast growth in Indiana. Yet I think there's like four ABA accredited law schools. So will we see some of this being addressed by more law schools?
Probably not. I think maybe a few. I know a number of college presidents, including colleges without law schools, having a medical center, having a law school, having a D1 football team. You know, those are kind of ritzy, glamorous things. To more address your question, should universities that don't have law schools, should standalones create law schools? Absolutely not. Because to your point about closings, this thing is always on a pendulum. Right now, we're on a 2 to 3 year surge. It's going to drop back down. It would be a horrible time, particularly with the headwinds of the demographic cliff coming. People didn't have babies during the Great Recession. The enrollment in college is about to drop down precipitously. So while we're on this little nice little, you know, upward spiral of applicants right now, that's not going to last. If you started a law school now and had to start paying your faculty bills in your merit aid scholarship and your building budget 3 years from now, you would not be a happy dean of a law school.
Mike, let's game this out for a second, because as you've noted and as we've seen, obviously the number of applicants and the number of folks who go to law school is a bit cyclical and there are a number of things that go into it. But, you know, let's game this out over the next few years. Say that, you know, we've got this surge of at least several years where law schools are admitting probably at least a few more people than they otherwise would because of the increase in the applicant pool. But given the advent of AI and a number of other things that we often talk about here, and which I'm sure you look at very closely, what can we reasonably expect gaming this out a few years after these folks apply, go to law school, start practicing, especially against the backdrop of phenomenon like AI? Do you see growth in the profession, or do you just see greater turnover among the people who end up graduating law school and going out into the world with a law degree?
Yeah, and this gets right back to Rich's question about more law schools. When we game it out and we're asked to as a firm by universities and law schools and applicants, you know, even long before AI, Richard Freeman, an economist at Harvard University, talked about these endogenous cycles of law school applicants. So what did he mean by recursive endogenous cycles? You get a spike in applicants, and then 4 years later, you have more people graduating from law school. The hiring market gets harder. Salaries stay frozen. People see that, and then you get this decrease in applicants. It's recursive. It creates upon itself. We don't know when it's going to happen, whether it's next year or the following year or the following year. But what we do know, because I've been doing this personally 26 years, and we look back into the 1940s, is things are going to slide back down. So jobs will get more competitive. And then you mentioned AI, right? So your typical first year, second year, third year associate at a law firm is going to get 80% more efficient because AI is going to be doing a lot of the discovery that they don't have to do. So hiring is going to get, I mentioned the 9.3 out of every 10 get jobs right now. If I had to guess, and prediction is difficult, But if I had to guess, 4 years from now, we're looking at 7 out of every 10. So that then information feedback is immediate. People applying to graduate schools will see that. They'll see the frozen salaries. They'll see the 7 out of 10 instead of 9.3. And then less people will apply to law school. And if I'm going to say for the rest of my life, we're going to go through these recursive cycles of spikes in applications and then drops in applications, spikes and drops. It's easy to predict that. When it's going to exactly happen is a little bit more difficult to predict.
Like, one last question, sir. We only have about 60 seconds. Do you have data relating the increase in applicants to the, for lack of a better term, quality of the law student? In other words, because perhaps the law schools are becoming a little bit more selective about who they take, are more students sticking with the program, dropping out less, passing the bar, you know, at a high rate, things like that? Or is that hard to sort of quantify?
Yeah, bar passes is going up. I think if you were to measure quality by LSAT scores, which is a horrible way to do it, but it's one of the only data points we have, LSAT scores are drifting upward for sure. Median LSATs are going upward. I know we only have 60 seconds. Law school GPAs and medians last year in the 18.3% up cycle, by and large, went up.
Interesting.
Yeah. Mike, thank you so much. Mike Spivey, really appreciate the conversation. I know we could go longer.
I was about to say, you guys, yeah. I appreciate you all for having me and for keeping me from splurging on about this topic for hours.
You're a human AI, man. That's it. You got this stuff down. That's interesting.
That's what I do. This is the only thing I know about. Thanks, Rich. Thanks, Ryan. Thanks, Christina.
Don't forget to listen, like, and subscribe to the Legal Face-Off podcast on social media and WGNradio.com. Well, if you're feeling overwhelmed by life's decisions and uncertain of where you belong and trying to find your purpose, we've got you covered here on Legal Face-Off. We're joined by Michelle Truong Perrin Steinberg, author, public speaker, wife, mother, and professional relationship builder, also a seasoned international trade compliance leader, and is currently acting as SAP's chief legal counsel, export control sanctions for Americas. That's a lot for a business card. She's got a new book out called Kindly Michelle, Discover Your Path, Live with Purpose. Michelle, you're a very busy person. Thank you for coming out with us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
So Michelle, your recent book, Kindly Michelle, is a unique combination of personal memoir and empowerment piece. Tell us more about what inspired you to write your book.
Sure. I wrote it really to help law students, current law students, those thinking about a career in the law, to try to share my journey, because I am a first generation lawyer. I didn't have any lawyers in my family. I wrote it for women, underrepresented groups, so they can kind of see, you know, the path that I took, hopefully to encourage and inspire them.
Michelle, in your book, you talk about how your journey sort of began at childhood and led to your current position as in-house counsel, in addition to the many roles that Ryan described earlier. What are some takeaways from that journey? You know, what are some maybe key points during that journey that led you to where you are today?
Sure. I would say that, you know, you don't have to have it all figured out. Like, my journey is a winding road. I didn't really know what it was that I wanted to be when I was younger. I thought I was going to be one thing and ended up being a lawyer. So I don't think you have to have all the answers. I think if you're open to just different experiences, I think that can really help you. I also think it's important to kind of look back at your childhood and kind of think through, you know, what are some of the things you enjoyed early on? I think our childhood really a lot of clues to, you know, where you could go for a future career. I also think it helps to understand like what your values are, you know, what's important to you. And that can kind of help you with decisions as you go on in life.
So Michelle, what was it about your childhood specifically? You speak about your parents a lot. Tell us, you know, just to piggyback off of Rich's question, would love to hear a little bit more about your relationship with your family and your parents specifically that you think, I mean, it is really inspiring. I've got your book and I was reading it and, you know, just because there is a certain vulnerability in sharing, you know, things from your own life, because you never quite know how they're going to resonate with people. And so I'd love to hear a little bit more about that.
Yeah, sure. Like, my mom is from Vietnam and she came to the U.S. Without having anyone here. Like, she left her home country. I think that's very brave. I think I get a lot of like my bravery and willingness to try new things from her, because she kind of set the stage for me. So I saw her modeling that. And my father, you know, he grew up without having running water until he went to college. He was the first person in his family to graduate from college. And then he led a really great career in the Army, retired as a colonel, and still gave back as a government civilian for many years. So I saw their work ethic, and I took that away, their tireless work ethic, but also the fact that they gave back to their community, always wanting to pay it forward. And that's another reason why I also wrote this book, is to pay it forward. You know, at the end of the book, I also give a lot of resources that I found after law school, after I was in the working world. And I want to save people from, you know, having to find out, you know, where are all these good groups? Where can they build their network? Where are there people like them who want to help them succeed? Especially now in this job market, it's very tough. And I think, you know, having these resources like the Women Influence Power in the Law, Corporate Counsel Women of Color, and many others that I explained in the book, I think those are great resources for people.
Michelle, I want to get to some of those takeaways at the end of your book in a moment. But, you know, you mentioned something, or maybe Tina mentioned something that's got my attention. You know, I mean, you're, in addition to all your other roles, I mean, you're in a really serious legal job for a big multinational corporation. Did you feel any sensitivity, vulnerability, anything like that about exposing, you know, these very intimate details of your life, given that, you know, you're in a very, you're with a very conservative company, you're in corporate America, you're dealing with big transactions, you're dealing with, you know, people who you don't know intimately yet, they might read your book before they get into a meeting with you and know all about these personal issues. How did you reconcile those two competing issues?
Well, I always want to be open and transparent. I mean, my leadership style is that way, is to be open and transparent. And so I lead that way. I want to be authentic. My main goal is to try to help another person. I mean, I try to talk to as many law students and students in general as I can, but I can't reach everybody. So that's why I'm hoping that the book can reach people that I can't reach. And as long as I'm being true to myself and sharing my personal story, I think being vulnerable is an asset. I think that's, you know, that's a way that you can relate to other people. I think some people can relate to my story. I think people can see how they can be encouraged. And I think there's something in the book for everybody to take away.
So give us, if you could give us maybe your top one or two takeaways of the many in your book that are excellent, what would you recommend, or what would you advise are the best takeaways? If you could pick a couple, it's like picking your favorite kids, I bet, right?
But yeah. Yeah, I would say you don't have to go the traditional path. I mean, you know, as a lawyer, I think a lot of us are feeling like you have to have it all laid out. You have to go A, B, C, D. But I don't think that's the case. I mean, I think it's okay. And when I talk to young students and young people, they're afraid of making a mistake. I don't think you can make a mistake. I think if you do something with the best information that you have, you make a decision and it turns out not to be the right thing, you can always do something else. So I hope that people see that with all the different roles that I've had, some of them I've had for a short period of time, but each role set me up for the next one and I took something away from that role. So it's okay to, you know, make different changes. So the non-traditional path too is that most law students would go to their traditional law firm after graduation, but you can build a successful career in the law not going that route. And I explain a way to do that. And I hope that encourages those students who don't feel like they fit that traditional mold. So I would say one of the things is you don't have to go the traditional route. The other is you don't have to have it all figured out.
So, Michelle, I wanted to let you know, and I'm not sure if you were aware of this or not, but when you and I connected in the spring, our conversation really resonated with me to the point where I actually wrote a couple of books with my husband, with Megs, over the summer, and just want to thank you so much for your generosity and your inspiration to me personally to do that. I think that your book is really inspirational and there is something for everybody. I would just love to hear, and this will also inspire our listeners, how do you juggle All the things that you are doing, all of which are super important, both to you as well as to the others whom you impact.
Well, Tina, thank you so much for saying that. That makes me feel good that, you know, that I could help you and that now you and your husband have your stories out there to help others. That's really the greatest joy. That's why I wrote the book, to encourage others. And I feel like everybody has a story to tell also, you know, and Meg's is a great person. And, you know, I'm glad that that worked out. I would say, balancing is tricky. I wouldn't say I always get it right. But one of the things that I have learned along the way is to be present wherever I am. So however it is that I choose to spend my time, I am intentional with that time, and I'm not trying to think about all the other things. I try to be very present. The other thing is I ask for what I want. I've learned that along the way too. You know, it's okay to set boundaries. You know, everybody is struggling a lot of things, and I think you have to tell people what you need. So I think telling people, setting the boundaries, protecting what's important to you, I think that can help you achieve a lot of different things. I also think having a support system. I have a great support system, and I talk about this in the book, having a very supportive spouse. I think that's very helpful. I also think my parents are very supportive, but also in the professional world, there's a team of people that are behind me that support me. And I think it's, you know, that support system that helps me get everything done. So I think for others, it's finding that support system.
All right. Where can we find the book?
Amazon has it, as well as Barnes & Noble and wherever books are sold.
Borders? Right. Can we go to the Borders and buy one, pick one up, or no?
Online, you can.
You probably learned a lot about that process, haven't you, in all of this?
I bet you have. The book publishing world is so large. It's so much to learn with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's Kindly Michelle by Michelle Trong Perrin Steinberg. Thanks so much for coming on with us and sharing this.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Rich Lenkoff is an attorney with Downey & Lenkoff, a firm with offices in Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin. Rich is consistently recognized by clients like McDonald's, Target, Macy's, Wendy's, and the Chicago Bears for his zealous advocacy and outstanding litigation results. Rich's many accolades include being named as an Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 to present and leading lawyer from 2012 to present. These are designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, serving on the Legal Prep Charter Academy Advisory Board and the Northern Illinois University College of Law Board of Visitors. Rich is also a producer with credits including 85, The Greatest Team in Football History, starring Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka. Renegades, a Caesar's Palace production starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon, Rock of Ages, and Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel in concert. In addition to hosting WGN's Legal Face-Off since 2014, Rich serves as a legal analyst for a variety of media outlets. Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional malpractice, and intellectual property, among other practice areas. For more information about Rich and Downey & Lenkoff, please visit dl-firm.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off on WGN, and it's time for the Legal Grab Bag. We're joined today by repeat offender, repeat guest, Sanford Williams, a lecturer at the law school at UCLA School of Law, and Kiara Imani Williams, attorney, writer, and co-founder of Like You, a company creating products to help facilitate human connection and meaningful conversations. Thank you both for coming on.
Yes, happy to be here.
Yes, thank you.
All right, let's start in Illinois. A jury has found a white former Illinois sheriff's deputy guilty of second-degree murder in the fatal shooting of Sonia Massey, a black woman inside of her home after she called 911 back in 2024. Tina, this story got a lot of national attention.
Well, Ryan, so as you mentioned last week, a jury found Sean Grayson, a former Illinois sheriff's deputy in Sangamon County, guilty of second-degree murder in the fatal shooting of Sonia Massey. He had been charged with a total of 3 counts in connection with Massey's death: first-degree murder, aggravated battery with a firearm, and official misconduct. His sentencing is scheduled for the end of January, and he faces up to 20 years in prison or may be given probation. The incident occurred in July of 2024 when Massey called 911 to report a possible intruder at her home. Grayson and another deputy responded and did not find an intruder. An altercation then ensued. Massey at the time was experiencing a mental health crisis and had picked up a pot of hot water. Grayson had proceeded to shoot her 3 times, fatally wounding her in the head. Grayson had claimed that he had shot Massey in self-defense. The assistant state's attorney said that this was a lie that Grayson repeatedly told on the stand. Grayson's partner's body cam footage was pretty telling in this case, showing that Grayson pointed to the pot of boiling water and told her, Massey to walk away from it. She appeared to then pour the water into the sink. Grayson threatened to shoot her, and Massey apologized and ducked down, covering her face. And then as she rose, Grayson shot her 3 times in the face. Interestingly, Grayson did not have his own body cam turned on until after the shooting. Ben Crump and Antonio Romanucci, who are both attorneys for Massey's family, said in a statement last week that the verdict is still a measure of justice for Sonia Massey and that they're hopeful that the court will impose a meaningful sentence that reflects the severity of these crimes and the life that was lost. Rich, very, very sad story, and a lot of people thinking that justice was not necessarily served here by any means.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Ben and Tony, they're both friends of the show. They've been on many, many times on our 10 plus years, and lots of, you know, a couple of legal things I want to touch on in this case. I mean, I'm sure everyone has seen the video by now. The video is pretty telling. You know, this now convict said that his life was threatened because Massey was raising a pot. The video shows that the pot wasn't even raised. She was holding it almost in self-defense. She did say, you know, something about in the name of Jesus, and he felt threatened by that. You know, we see clearly in the video, he says, I'm going to shoot you in the face. So the video, I think, tells the whole story. But even without the video, right, let's see what we know about this officer. He's only 30 years old, right? He was thrown out of 5 different police departments in the state of Illinois in a 4-year period. There was audio of one of his disciplinary meetings where he was being, you know, he was being disciplined by one of his commanding officers for not doing his job. Before he was a cop, he was in the Army. And in a 2-year period, he had 2 DUIs. He was that led to his discharge. So as much as this is a clear-cut case of a criminal murdering someone, this is also a failure of the system and this is not the first time this has happened. I'm a big supporter of the police, you know, but for this guy to get not one, not two, but 6 different jobs in law enforcement is crazy. And what do you think is going to happen but something like this when someone has that history? So I think it's a failure of the system. I really do. And I think it's a real failure of the system. In addition to this one individual, you know, getting off easy, in my opinion, for, you know, not showing the proper judgment to handle the situation differently than shooting her in the face and killing her. Sanford, what are your thoughts?
Oh, I think you hit on 2 big points. One, the system failed us all. He should not have been able to get so many jobs. But it also shows that sometimes officers act in these cases with impunity. Fortunately, we have body cam and video now to show what he did, but the fact that he was able to lie with impunity pretty much and deny what we saw with our eyes, it's kind of sad. That notwithstanding, of course, and you alluded to this, police have one of the hardest jobs out there. So we support them in trying to do their jobs, but there has to be some kind of, you know, control, and the system definitely failed us all here, I think, in this respect.
Jerry, you've seen the video, I assume. It should be noted, by the way, that one of Massey's relatives was involved in a riot in 1908 in that very county that led to the founding of the NAACP.
Mm. Yeah, I'm definitely going to agree here. I think what is scary about these cases is that a lot of times it turns on the officer saying that they have some sort of, you know, split second decision making of whether or not I thought I was in danger. And a lot of times the conversation tends to happen around that. Did the officer reasonably believe they were in danger and had to protect themselves? Here, we were lucky enough to have objective video evidence where you can see, if you watch the video, there was not a split second decision. There was a full conversation. There was an intentional decision. I watched the video. I have friends who have been in mental health episodes. I don't know if anyone else has experienced that. And she did seem a little bit, you know, maybe discombobulated. There was nothing about her behavior that screamed dangerous. And then also, I think one thing that struck out here is being shot 3 times in the face is egregious. It's one thing to say, you know, as a cop, I shot her hand because she had the pot and I thought that was going to be the thing to hurt me. It's another thing to say, I took her life. I was really intentional about it. And I made sure she wasn't coming back. Three shots is crazy. So I'm just glad here that we do have cops that are starting to wear body cams because, you know, as everyone pointed out, it's not an easy job. This is a scary job. And sometimes I acknowledge cops do have to make split second decisions where they actually are in danger. And I want cops to be able to feel that they can defend themselves. But defending yourself and taking the life of another recklessly are completely different actions.
All right, so let's go from Illinois to Virginia, where a teacher has filed a lawsuit after being shot by a six-year-old student inside her own classroom. Tina, now it sounds like she's suing a former assistant principal.
Yeah, Ryan. So last week, the civil trial got underway involving that former Virginia elementary school teacher who was shot in her classroom by a six-year-old student. Abby Zwerner, who taught first grade in Newport News, is suing former assistant principal Ebony Parker for $40 million, saying she was grossly negligent by ignoring multiple warnings that the student had a gun in his possession in the hours before the January 2023 shooting. Parker allegedly had the authority, but did not search the student or remove him from the classroom or call law enforcement. Apparently, the shooting occurred on the first day that he had returned from a suspension for having damaged Zwerner's phone a couple of days earlier. Zwerner was shot in the hand and in the chest as she sat at a reading table and spent nearly 2 weeks in the hospital, requiring six surgeries and still not having full use of her left hand. Ebony Parker's defense is that the shooting was not reasonably foreseeable, and that no one could have imagined that a six-year-old would possibly bring a firearm to school. Her attorney said to jurors that this is really the crux of the case and warned of the jurors using hindsight bias or Monday morning quarterbacking. Parker's the only defendant in the lawsuit. The district superintendent and school principal have already been dismissed out of the case. She's facing a separate criminal trial next month on eight counts of felony child neglect. Each of the counts is punishable by up to 5 years in prison. The student's mother has already been sentenced to a total of nearly 4 years in prison for felony child neglect and federal weapons charges. Rich, this case is understandably being watched closely as it could set precedent for holding school officials accountable for gun violence on school property.
Yeah, I mean, two issues here legally, notice and responsibility, two very simple terms, really, and ones we deal with in lots of lawsuits. Was there adequate notice that could be charged on the assistant principal when four separate people went to her about concerns with this child bringing a gun to school? Reasonable question. I think it's going to depend a lot on, obviously, on the credibility of the witnesses. But, you know, the bigger issue and one that we're seeing a trend in is responsibility. I mean, is it the schools and, you know, their agent, in this case, the assistant principal's responsibility to ensure the safety of students? Now, certainly there's a duty, a legal duty, once they're in the building to ensure the student, you know, to reasonably ensure the safety of students. But, you know, whose responsibility is it to make sure that a six-year-old doesn't go to school with a gun? You would hope it's the parent. It, besides the parent, is it the principal? Again, depends on how much notice they have. But we see this trend, Kiara, with especially school shootings, of holding others responsible. Most frequently, we've seen parents. In this case, it's someone besides the parent.
Yeah, I think I understand holding the parent responsible maybe a little bit more. They had to get this weapon from somewhere. They left the house. They brought it to school. A lot of things happened in between the shooting that you're looking at the parents like, how did this happen? I think when it comes to holding the school systems accountable, my opinion, unless they've done something particularly egregious in this case, I would be interested in knowing exactly what that notice looked like. You know, they said that the teacher was on notice, but, you know, was it credible? Were there people who had said things about this kid before and that turned out to be not true? Was it the boy who cried wolf? We just don't have enough information, or I don't, about what that particular notice is. But if we're going to be holding schools accountable, to me, it almost seems like you have to enforce something like a metal detector with schools, because to what extent are teachers responsible for searching kindergartners? Are we searching their lunch boxes? Are we searching their backpacks? Are we doing this every day? I think that's kind of an awkward and difficult position to put someone who went to school to teach children, right? Understandably, they probably love to teach. They specialize in math or English or, you know, play. We're talking about 5 or 6 year olds. They're not necessarily someone who's equipped with searching and doing pat downs for guns. So I think, I don't know, holding the school system accountable here, I think, is a slippery slope.
And for part of the defense here is that who would expect a 6 year old of all people to have a gun? Bad argument. I mean, I'm not persuasive, right? Is anyone here shocked? Is anyone really unfortunately shocked today by a 6 year old shooter? It would be, you know, 20 years ago. It's not that part of the defense is not persuasive now, I think.
Right. Well, this case really hit me because I was on the school board in Manassas, Virginia for 12 years before I moved out here to LA. So we had to deal with not this situation, but similar situations. And the first thing I look at is like the legal standard. And I remember from law school, negligence, it's duty, breach of duty, proximate cause, and damage. The school has a duty to protect children. And in this case, because the principal had notice from 4 different people, she had a duty, I believe, to check to make sure that the kid didn't have a gun. It's one thing if the kid just walked into school with a gun and no one knew, but I think the notice that the principal had is enough that they should have at least investigated, because they didn't investigate and then the damage obviously occurred. I think the court could credibly hold that the school was responsible. I think, as Kira alluded to, this is slippery slope, and it's kind of hard to figure out, you know, where the responsibility is. But I would always say from, you know, the podium, and I think that we all felt in the school system, that our number one job was to protect and educate the students. And it seems that in this case, the principal may not have fully been on board with, you know, protecting the students to the extent they could have, and or the teacher.
All right, let's go to California now. Rich has entered the, he's entered the chat, everyone. All right, an interesting twist in the saga between Justin Baldoni and Blake Lively. Rich, Baldoni's lawyers apparently missed a key deadline, huh?
Yeah, I mean, he already, the case against Blake Lively was dismissed already. Now, kind of surprisingly, the case was dismissed, the underlying case was dismissed because Baldoni's lawyers missed a deadline. This is a federal court case, Tina. You know, I guess they can file a motion to reinstate, but given how much notoriety this case has gotten and how much bickering and how much, you know, back and forth there has been, I don't know that the case will be reinstated. That's a pretty serious deadline to miss. Hopefully, it's the end of the story for Legal Face.
Yeah. I know, kind of like our coverage of the Rust saga that went on for like 5 years. You know, yeah, Rich, I have to agree with you. I would think that the level of sophistication of the lawyers that Justin Baldoni has, that, you know, this whole, you know, appearance of oops, we've missed a date, just seems a little bit odd. I'm wondering if they are going to file a motion to reinstate, just given how these folks have been bludgeoning each other with litigation over the last few months. I don't know. If his lawyers really just pulled an oops on this, then I have to question how he's spending so much money on lawyers that pull an oops on a deadline like this.
Yeah, specifically, I mean, this was the defamation countersuit. It was the $400 million countersuit, and they were given, Baldoni's attorneys were given the opportunity to file what's called an amended complaint. And, you know, they didn't do that. So you got to assume that they're no longer pursuing it, which is strange. Again, given how much money and time has been spent and notoriety in this case, Sanford, you're in LA. What do you think?
Well, it's funny. What I know about this case is from my daughters. So they informed me about it, but just being here in LA and talking to folks about it, you both mentioned it. With the notoriety, the money, the time they spend, there's no excuse to miss a deadline. My students here at UCLA miss a deadline. I mean, they get a bad grade. So there's no excuse for lawyers to miss a deadline like that. And I think they may have missed it probably because they didn't think they had a case, because they thought that their case was credible or had a chance to move forward, they'd have missed the deadline. And as you both alluded to, the original suit is still intact that was live and filed. So it'll be interesting to see how that transpires going forward.
All right, from California, let's go to Texas. A wealthy woman from Texas is on trial after hitting and killing a man with her Porsche Rich, she's blaming her pricey heels.
Crazy story. You know, this woman is named Christina Chambers. She's now 34. The allegation is that she was driving her Porsche 911 at 70 miles an hour when she hit an individual who was walking with a girl. I guess they're on a first date. It was something like 2:30 a.m. They were coming back from getting donuts. And she struck a curb and, you know, he flew 30 feet in the air and was killed on the scene, was pronounced dead on the scene. You know, where this story takes an interesting legal turn is that she was arrested. She was charged with second-degree manslaughter. It was found that she had at least one bag, maybe more bags of cocaine in her pockets. She blew a .301, more than three times the legal limit of intoxication. She said she had six alcoholic beverages and admitted to using cocaine when she got into her car that night. And her defense turned into this, I was wearing these high-priced shoes with heels, and the heels caught into the, you know, gas pedal. And instead of braking, I hit the gas and I jumped the curb. If convicted, Tina, she faces 2 to 20 years in prison. She's also, of course, facing a civil suit by the family of the deceased. So, you know, part of the argument, though, would be, let's even assume that she can credibly convince a jury that it was the fault of the heels, right? I don't know. Maybe don't wear high heels like that when you're driving a Porsche drunk and high on coke at 2:30 a.m. and driving seven, you know, like getting into the car with the heels is in and of itself enough to warrant the charge, right?
I agree, Rich. I mean, and that's exactly how I was going to frame it, as a woman who has worn heels, especially in my younger years. I have to say that when I wear heels and I go and drive my car, I actually have a pair of flats with me. I take my heels off, put my flats on, and then proceed to drive my car for the very reason that I don't want my heels to interfere with my ability to drive safely. That's just kind of what you do. But I think we all know what's really going on here. This is the only possible concocted defense that she could come up with, is blame it on the heels. She was coked up. She was drunk. She got behind the wheel and killed somebody. It's as simple as that.
Yeah. Kiara, I don't know much about Christian Louboutins, but, you know, they cost around $1,000 each. Just if you knew nothing else about sort of appealing to a jury, right, when you're trying to argue that your client's not responsible in the death of this innocent young person, you're driving a Porsche, you're high on coke, witnesses say you were bouncing around bars in this high-end area of Houston, right? You're drunk. You're also going to argue that your $1,000 shoes were responsible? I mean, how stupid is that defense? Like, what juror who never would even dream of spending $1,000 on shoes is going to say, yeah, you know what? You're right. Walk free.
Now, listen, I'm going to play devil's advocate here, devil wears Prada advocate. I took my driving test in heels at 17, and I, to this day, believe that the reason I failed was because I had my heels on. Had I been wearing sneakers, I think I would have passed the test. So I can agree that driving in heels, you know, sometimes you just can't control where that heel goes. That being said, you know, she is a lot older than 16, and I imagine that, like Christina and myself, she's had experience driving in heels and should know that driving in heels is not a good decision. So again, this definitely sounds like I made a terrible decision. Sounds like her counsel might have watched a couple episodes or watched the movie Legally Blonde. I don't know if you guys remember that, where the case turned on like the women taking a shower after she got a perm. They're probably like, okay, what sort of creative argument can we use to get out of this one that pertains to like your life, your fashionable life? I don't know. I think anybody looking at this case can see that's clearly not the reason why, unfortunately, someone was murdered in this case. And I'm going to use the word murder because, man, reckless. Not only are you driving a Porsche in heels, you're on cocaine. It's dark. It's, you know, what were you thinking here? There were a lot of bad decisions that led up to this.
Kiara, do you have a spare pair of flats like Tina?
I personally take off my heels and drive barefoot. So, you know, but again, you learn very quickly if you've ever worn heels and driven that driving in heels is not a good idea. The takeaway for anybody listening to this, don't drive in high heels. It's never worth it. And, you know, if you're younger, you'll fail your driver's test. Also, having to retake a driver's test, not fun.
Yes, Rich, you're writing this down. Do not drive in heels. You got that?
I could throw in there too, Ryan, real quick. Kiara, I think, went to law school, not because I went to law school, because of Legally Blonde. So
that's about half the guests we've had on this show, by the way, just so you know. All right. You may remember the story out of Los Angeles about the Angels pitcher, Tyler Skaggs, who died of a fatal overdose in 2019. Zach's wife's now suing the team, saying they could have done more to stop his addiction. Rich, you threw this one into the bag for us.
Yeah, he was found dead in a Texas hotel room following a road trip. Tox reports show that he had a mix of fentanyl, alcohol, oxy. His family filed, as you mentioned, a wrongful death suit against the Angels, saying that they were aware and involved in this drug use while pitching. One of the key employees was this guy named Eric Kay, who was actually convicted and sentenced to 22 years in prison. So in the wake of that, the family saying there's some civil responsibility here too in the wake of the criminal conviction, because the team either knew or should have known of this employee operating this drug operation, supplying drugs to this player, and they're responsible. And again, they're saying they actually knew, because there's some evidence of texts and stuff where the team allegedly knew. The team is saying they're denying that. They're saying that they were not involved, that this was a rogue employee. You know, there's a key legal question here, Tina, as to whether when an employee like this acts, whether they're acting within the scope of their employment or beyond it, whether they're, you know, a rogue agent, and whether a team could be responsible. I mean, the Angels probably, you know, they might have 1,000, you know, 2,000 employees. Can they possibly be responsible for all the illegal actions of every one of them? Again, this case, which began last week in Orange County, will turn a lot on credibility of witnesses. I mean, people like Mike Trout, who's, you know, the arguably one of the two or three best players in baseball still, who's the most prominent Angel. He has testified on the case. So, it's a key question as to how much a team and their employees have responsibility for this kind of thing. And it's a test of whether, you know, a jury will convict a team as high profile in their community as the Angels of this kind of negligence.
Yeah, Rich. I mean, we've covered a lot of stories like this in some shape or form over the years, and I agree with your assessment that, and a lot of it is very fact specific, right? I mean, ultimately, you know, this is a he said, she said, and ultimately, it's going to be driven by what actually happened or didn't happen, because there are some allegations that, you know, there were a bunch of team players around when these things were going on. And you know, was it true? Was it not true? It's hard to tell. And as you said, how credible are some of the folks that are witnesses here, especially when you're talking about people who were married, who are no longer married? Are there ulterior motives to testifying a certain way and all of that?
I see some parallels, Sanford, between this case and the case that got a lot of attention the last 2 weeks involving the three NBA or two NBA players, one ex-NBA, one current NBA, one current NBA coach, all of whom were arrested by the FBI, you know, involving different gambling schemes. Notably in that case, you didn't hear too much about the team's liability, right? So you could easily argue in those situations that because they're employees of the Heat and the Blazers, that those teams have some liability there too. But that's not at least being made in this current situation.
First, the case is big out here, as you mentioned, out here in Southern California. I think two things. One, with the NBA gambling case, I think the folks who were impacting the games were doing it more on their personal level. So it'll be harder to discern what they were doing. So a club or a manager or coach in the NBA couldn't necessarily see what someone was doing there. But in this case, especially the evidence, people said on planes, I could see he was passing out pills. These teams, they look at their players and they know how much they drink, where they go, where they are at all times. So they're very, very protective and observant of what their players do. So it kind of makes you feel that how could a team not know that this person, the employee, was giving these drugs to Skaggs? And what buttresses that allegation is the evidence that, you know, folks said they saw him passing out, you know, drugs to folks.
Yeah, great points. Kiara, what are your thoughts on this one?
Yeah, I work in the entertainment industry and sports entertainment. They're often very intertwined. I think what's hard about my industry particularly is that this is something that runs rampant from agencies to production studios to athletics to social media. You can see we have evidence of players and entertainers engaging in drugs and alcohol, and it runs so rampant that I think it becomes an issue of, well, if we hold everybody accountable, are we going to have a team? Are we going to have entertainers? And sadly, I think it's become kind of a thing where people turn a blind eye, but we're starting to see that there's a lot of harm that comes from turning a blind eye. So if there is some sort of switch here, I think it's going to have to be not just a legal one, but a very socially conscious, you know, movement of these teams and agencies and production studios to say, hey, when we see the behavior, let's call it out. Let's stop it. From my personal experience, the only time I've seen, you know, people step in when the business does have some knowledge of this type of behavior is when it's affecting the player or when it's affecting the performance. Like if the actor is not remembering lines, if the player is dropping balls, then they're like, well, now we got to do something. But to the extent that it's not affecting the job performance, I think sadly what's normal is to kind of pretend like you don't know what's happening.
Sure. All right, let's go to Michigan now. A Michigan police officer appeared in court to testify. That's normal. He did it on Zoom, which post-pandemic, that's normal. He did it without wearing pants. Rich, is that normal?
Not so much. Not for members of the law enforcement.
I was interested to see how you would respond to that. It's not so bad.
I mean, I was going to dress as the guy for our Halloween episode here, but
too many lawyers on the call, man. Can't do that.
Lisa, are we going to show? I don't know if I asked Lisa to pull the video, but I'm sure many, many people have seen it. Here we go.
Can you put your appearance on the record, please?
Yes, Officer Jackson, badge number 3919, out of the 12th precinct.
All right.
You got Officer Tomer, Judge.
You got some pants on, Officer?
Sir, they're in the. No, sir.
No.
Officer Jackson.
So lots of takeaways. Number one, there's a split second there. Just leave the video, Lisa, where the police officer is thinking about whether he should, how he should answer that question. And to his credit, he says no. I mean, he could have came up with a million answers. That was a filter, or my pants are really thin and skin colored. To his credit, the look on the bailiff or the assistant's face is great, right? And then also the judge. I listened to this now probably 77 times. And a lot of people online are convinced that he starts to say, cuz, you know, kind of drops the robe and drops the formality of a judge. And he says, cuz, or he may say, he might be saying counselor because he's used to say, I still want to go with him just saying cuz like you would to a friend, like, cuz, are you serious? Are you not wearing pants? Just added to the litany of great videos we have of people, you know, not using their best judgment on video in court. I feel bad for the guy, though. Ultimately, like most of the times that we mock these people, I don't feel too bad. I feel bad for this guy just because, besides the fact that he's a cop, he's probably got a lot of stress and it's hard being a cop. You know, this is like his thing now forever. He's pantsless video guy and I just feel bad for him. Who among us hasn't appeared on some kind of formal video with, you know, business up top, party down below? Tina?
I am not being lumped into that. That being said, I do feel badly for him. I mean, because there are people who do this and I'm not casting judgment on them. It's just, this could have been the case of the unfortunately positioned camera. Had he positioned the camera a little bit better, none of this would have ever happened. So, but at least unlike some of the other liars we've talked about on today's show, he didn't lie about it.
The Rich, is that your eyes up here situation going on?
I'm not judging him for not wearing pants. This is a virtual world. I work with a bunch of attorneys and I guarantee you that a number of them have showed up to negotiations with no pants on. If anything, I think the professionalism falls to where the camera's placed, right? Like at the very least, I expect you to get on camera early, do a little trial run, whatever you got going on below the camera. None of my business. Just make sure we don't know about it.
Right. Now, I'm like Kiara too. I don't judge him, but I always wear pants because I'm paranoid, thanks to my wife and my kids. I do like the fact that he was honest. And I do think Rich has a good point because I think he did judge kind of talking colloquially, like, yo, cuz, what's up? Like, I can't believe you're doing this. And then he caught himself. So that was interesting.
I mean, I think there's more for these guys. I think we need like a series for with these two guys, cuz and the judge.
You're right, though. You know he totally got the business when he went back to the police station, right? Like,
just a million pants on his desk. I mean, let's give him credit. At least he was seemingly wearing shorts. That would have been worse.
It's true. It's true. It's true.
Way worse.
There was fabric. There was fabric. We saw fabric. Okay. I mean,
who's to say that you're all wearing pants now? You know, unless we're checking everybody, we would just never know.
I don't know.
You know I'm wearing pets, Kiara, so.
All right. Well, as is holiday tradition, Tina wraps us up with holiday lawsuits. Tina, we're looking at six spooky lawsuits for Halloween 2025.
Yeah, Ryan, and we could spend all day and night talking about these lawsuits. I'd say that, you know, this is one of our favorite segments here on Legal Face Off when we talk about lawsuits relating to various holidays during the course of the year. And so I'd say that these lawsuits fall into a couple of buckets. The first are those lawsuits involving costumes and other holiday things like holiday decorations that don't quite do what they're supposed to. And then the second bucket is people's reactions to scary things, whether it's decorations or haunted houses. And then the third are near and dear to my heart as an intellectual property lawyer, where you see lawsuits of people involving, for example, costumes, where they're saying that somebody else's costume is infringing theirs. My personal favorite of the lawsuits that we have on tap here involves the Mary Had a Little Lamb costume. It's a woman who, you know, a bunch of years ago now dressed as Mary. And her boyfriend was the lamb. They decided to glue Johnson & Johnson cotton balls to him. And for some unknown reason, this guy decided that he was going to light a cigarette using a butane lighter while he had all of these cotton balls on him. After the couple sued J&J, J&J was able to get a new trial, in part because this is just ridiculous behavior. But also, the fact of the matter is that this is not a foreseeable use of cotton balls. And so the notion that there wasn't a warning on the package, Rich, really was irrelevant here, because this is not what cotton balls are meant to do. So I would love to throw it to Rich and to others on our round table here to tell us which of these cases really spoke to them.
Speaking of cotton, you know what makes great cotton? Shalima. They make the best cotton anywhere in the world, but we're bringing it home. We're going to make cotton here in the USA, not China. Thank you. I like the story with the banana. Oh, hold on.
Oh, my gosh. I almost passed out. How is a banana protectable, Tina? I mean, isn't a banana a banana? There's the case of the kangaroo manufacturing and Kmart sued. Or they were sued by this company called Rasta Impasta.
It's Rasta Impasta.
Right. And it went all the way to federal court, and they found that Rasta Impasta's banana was protectable, that it was distinctive. They said that the company was entitled to the veritable fruits of their intellectual labor. Isn't
it? And they made a pun in the process.
Aren't there a million banana costumes out there? Like, how is that?
There are, but there was something very special about this one that made this an infringement.
All right. How about Sanford? Who is responsible when you go to a haunted house and, I don't know, you're actually scared and you turn and you fall, you trip? I mean, all those, you know, there's all those lawsuits all the time. Or when, even though you sign a waiver, right, which we all do when we go to these haunted houses, you're still suing. What happened to the responsibility of these people?
I feel you. I mean, if you go to a haunted house, prepare to be scared. I don't like haunted houses, so I don't go unless my daughter's dragging me to a haunted house. The case that really got me was the first case about the cotton ball, though, because I think the defendants or the plaintiffs, excuse me, said cotton didn't have a warning that it was flammable. I mean, come on, there has to be some responsibility. So it's unfortunate what happened. You don't want to see people get hurt, but people do have to, you know, accept some responsibility for their actions, especially adults who make the decision to do certain things.
All right, Kiara, what do you think?
Yeah, you know, acting reckless around the holidays, again, I can't judge it. I've definitely made some decisions. I used two-sided tape for things this Halloween that the two-sided tape was not intended for. Then I was very disappointed it didn't work the way it was supposed to. But I take the full blame. You know, we know how these things are supposed to be used. We step outside of the box and you suffer the consequences. I think trying to hold other people accountable for the consequences is crazy. The story that really got me was the one with the spiders, because I hate spiders. It was like a professor or something, a law professor that like threatened to shoot some like fake dangly spiders around. I fully empathize. I had some like fake spiders around for my house for Halloween this year and found one yesterday and almost had a heart attack. And I'm the one who decorated and I found it and still almost had a heart attack. So I think inflicting this type of thing on people who have no interest in being afraid feels very different than a haunted house where you go because you want to be scared. If you're just taking a walk around your neighborhood and you've got all these things popping out at you, you know, that feels a little bit unfair. So I get that a little bit more.
All right. Well, we'll end off after acknowledging that we've been joined by Doug without the Limu Emu. Doug.
Yeah. Great. Exactly. He's around here somewhere. Speaking of double-sided tape, you're going to see something pop up.
Now, we've done 10 years of these questions.
There you go. There it goes.
Great stash. I'm trying to think of a question we haven't covered before. How about, since you probably have some of this left in your house from Halloween, what is your least favorite Halloween candy? Therefore, the one that's probably still lingering in the bottom of the bowl. What is the Halloween candy, either today or when you were trick-or-treating, that you would just throw back or not take out of the bowl? We'll start with Ryan Burrow.
I don't like Whoppers.
You don't like your Whoppers?
I don't like Whoppers.
You don't see Whoppers that much anymore now that I think
about it. There's a reason for that. I don't like them.
They're big. I like the inside. I enjoy a Whopper. Kiara, what Halloween candy do you absolutely not take out of the bowl?
People feel very differently, but Reese's Pieces. I just don't feel chocolate and peanut butter don't go together. I don't know.
Wait, do you like any other Reese's products or just not Reese's Pieces?
I don't really like any Reese's, if I'm honest.
That's terrible. That's wrong.
For Reese's boycott.
Exactly.
By the way, this episode is sponsored. Two great things that go great together. Thanks for pissing off your sponsor. Sanford, yes. Least favorite Halloween candy.
Almond Joy. I'm not a big nut fan. I do like Reese's peanut butter cups. And Shara loves Twix, so I got a bag of Twix from your kid later.
Yeah, I do love Twix.
Twix, wow, that's a good one. Yeah, Almond Joy. No one on the planet likes Almond Joy. No.
I like Almond Joy. I don't know why they're catching.
I like
coconut. No way. Tina, least favorite.
Dots.
Don't say candy corn. Everyone says candy corn. Dots.
Those stuck in your teeth.
Ugh.
Yeah.
No way.
Lisa, least favorite.
I'm gonna go with kind of like the Mars bars. They're kind of boring.
Another sponsor bites the dust.
Yep.
Yeah.
We're hitting them all, Kiara.
Made in Chicago, right?
No, but you confuse us with Mars bars because Mars bars is like British and Canadian. Do they have Mars bars in the United States of America?
Yeah.
Well, I thought Mars is like, Mars owns a bunch of different brands.
Any product manufactured by Mars, Lisa hates.
All right. Milky Way. That's what it is. That's a Milky Way.
Milky Way. I asked because I love a Mars bar, but it's
I just Googled it and I see what you're talking about.
Yes, Milky Way. Oh, Milky Way is the greatest. Well, you stepped on my hot take on this is Kit Kat. Now you're gonna think I'm crazy because everyone
loves it. You're crazy.
Wait, here's my take. As a proud Canadian Kit Kat is like nectar from the gods. It's so much better than American. So when I taste an American Kit Kat at Halloween, it's like poison. Try a Canadian Kit Kat.
Well, you have to bring us some from Canada, exactly. Rich.
Absolutely.
The import tax is only 25% right now. We can make it happen. Oh, boy. All right. All right. We should wrap this up here. Do you have any more, Rich? Do you have any more props you want to get out before I spit this all out? Or are you good?
Good.
Okay. All right.
2028.
Thank you so much, Kiara and Sam.
I'm going to say 2028.
That'll do it for this latest installment of Legal Face-Off on WGN. Special thanks to Michelle Trong, Perrin Steinberg, author of Kindly Michelle, Mike Spivey, founder and CEO of Spivey Consulting Group, Michael Gerhardt. He is a professor of jurisprudence at UNC School of Law. Also want to give a shout out to Ben Anderson, Lisa Stegall, Fortina Martini, Rich Lenkov. I'm Ryan Breaux. Thanks again for joining us on Legal Face-Off on WGN.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Lenkov. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face-Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget...